DW Deutsche Welle. Worldlink.
Hello and welcome to DW's Worldlink, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. In Bonn, Germany, I'm Samantha Early.
And I'm Natalie Muller. On this week's show, self-reflection in Denmark following attacks on a freedom of speech forum and a synagogue.
Reflection in the US too, following the gun murders of three young, bright Muslim students.
And that was the first time that fear sort of crossed my mind. I've had an incredible experience growing up and living in America. The community here is fantastic, but it sort of hit me that, oh my gosh, that could have been me.
And we meet an anti-gun activist in the Philippines.
These stories and more coming up on Worldlink.
You're listening to DW's Worldlink, bringing you the personal stories behind the news headlines. In Bonn, Germany, I'm Samantha Early.
And I'm Natalie Muller.
Al-Qaeda and ISIL and groups like it are desperate for legitimacy. They try to portray themselves as religious leaders, holy warriors in defense of Islam. That's why ISIL presumes to declare itself the Islamic State. And they propagate the notion that America, and the West generally, is at war with Islam. That's how they recruit. That's how they try to radicalize young people. We must never accept the premise that they put forward, because it is a lie.
U.S. President Barack Obama there, speaking at a three-day anti-terror summit his country hosted this past week in the wake of the recent killings in Paris, Copenhagen, and Libya. Those killings were united by a thread of violent extremism committed in the name of Islam. Denmark, with its reputation as the happiest country in the world, was in shock this week following shooting attacks on a freedom of speech panel discussion held at a community centre and then a Jewish synagogue in the capital, Copenhagen. Two people were killed by a gunman suspected to be a 22-year-old Danish-born man of Palestinian origin named Omar al-Hussein before he himself was shot by police on Sunday.
Thousands of Danes attended an evening vigil on February 16th for the two victims, 55-year-old filmmaker Finn Norgaard and 37-year-old volunteer security guard Dan Uzan. We spoke to Copenhagen-based journalist Katrine Weibu, who was in the Danish countryside when the attacks took place. We began by asking her to describe the scene when she returned home.
We didn't really listen to the radio before Sunday morning and realised what has actually been going on, and that was quite a shock. And then we went back to Copenhagen early Sunday morning and came into this completely deserted town. I think people were quite scared to walk out. There were a lot of police cars, especially around the area where I live. It was quite scary and not a very nice place to come back to. Of course, I was looking on the news all the time and listening to the radio. And then on Facebook, my friend started to write about one of the guys who was shot, Finn Nurgle. And at that time, suddenly it became very close I realized that actually it was only about 5 minutes away from here. So I think for many people, many Danes, it has been a frightening experience realizing that this can actually happen and go on in your own town. People have been reading and writing about Copenhagen as being one of the safest places to live in the world. So Copenhagen feels very safe. So this is a very terrifying thing to happen.
Had people in Denmark, though, in some way been expecting something like this, given January's attacks in Paris and also Denmark's role in the controversy with the Muhammad cartoons?
I think when the Muhammad cartoons happened in Denmark, people were frightened and scared that something like this could happen. But then as time went on, things started to go back to normal again. There wasn't really a lot of discussions or debates. The police or the politicians didn't talk much about it. I don't think, even though it happened in Paris, I don't think people were expecting anything like this. There certainly wasn't much going on in the news and writing about more security, or that people should be alert, or people to be more careful about going around in Copenhagen. So there wasn't much talk about it at all. I certainly didn't feel very insecure and expecting anything like this to happen.
Those shootings were several days ago. What's the atmosphere like on the streets of Copenhagen now?
There are a lot of police around everywhere, especially in this part of the city where I'm living. And so you're constantly reminded. I think that still people feel a bit unsafe. But on the other hand, things have gone back to normal. There are children going to school. There are people coming home from work. People cycle all the time everywhere. So it's not like people are hiding or anything, or that you can feel have a sense in the streets, apart from the police cars, that there isn't an insecure feeling at all. But I still feel it's in the news a lot. The politicians are discussing it. Everybody are discussing it. So, of course, it's something that everybody are aware of. And I think something that will stick with us for quite a long time.
Has it changed, or will it change, do you think, the way you go about your life in Copenhagen, and in what ways?
I think people are quite determined that this is not going to affect us. I think people are quite determined that our values, that we want to live in a safe country, we want to keep our values as being open-minded and friendly and creating a safe environment for children and being able to cycle around and being able to say what we want to and have plays in the open and meet up and go for demonstrations, etc. I think people are very aware that this is still going to happen. And I think what it has done is to make people talk about what are Danish values. What is it that is so strong about Danish identity? What is it that we really want to keep in Denmark? I think that is something we have talked lots about in the past few days. And I think perhaps sometimes it feels a bit insecure with all the police cars driving around. But I think on the other hand, people are very determined that this is not going to change the Danish culture and our values and our priorities in life.
Did you attend Monday's vigil for the victims?
I did, yes. And I think especially there was so much talk about Danish values. There was so much talk about what we should keep and what we should be concerned about. And I think the Prime Minister did a very good speech. There were good speeches from a lot of different people, the police as well. And I think they really brought people together. And I was quite amazed how many people who turned up as well. It was a very beautiful event.
You've spoken about Danish values, but is there anything in the aftermath of these shootings that's perhaps threatened those values?
I think also it has divided Denmark in some way. There's a lot of discussion going on in Denmark. There's a massive debate about the freedom of speech. You have this group who's defending freedom of speech and defending the fact that they can draw any cartoons that they like. But then you also have a group who says that even though we have freedom of speech and even though we should protect that, we also have a responsibility for not provoking, for not insulting other cultures. And just when you read on Facebook and read all the discussions that's going on there, that's something that people are very much debating at the moment. I also think there's a big discussion at the moment about young second-generation immigrants, how they fit or perhaps don't fit in the Danish society. Young males particularly, young girls seem to do very well academically, but there's a group of young males who don't really fit in, and instead of feeling that they do fit in, they fight society instead. And we found out that the young guy who was responsible for the shootings, that he was part of a group who was very, very criminal. So there's a lot of concern about what do we do with these young people as well.
Thanks to Katrine Weibu, speaking with us there from Copenhagen.
To another community in mourning, in the United States, where the killing of three American students has led to questions about the way that their murders have been covered in the media. Dental student Diyar Barakat, his wife Yusur Abusalha, and her sister Razan Abusalha were found shot dead at their flat close to the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. As well as community-minded students with promising futures, the three were all Muslims, and obviously so, as both young women wore headscarves. Their killer has since turned himself in, but the coverage of the murders in the ensuing days prompted concern about whether Muslim victims receive the same treatment when attacked by non-Muslims as the other way around. A good friend of the three victims, American born and raised Aya Zuri, knew them well through the local Muslim community, having gone to school and then university with them. She's been talking to reporter Jeff Hamlin for DW.
Is this a picture of...
Yeah.
Who is that?
So this is Yusur, and this is in third grade, and we had a carnival at school, and we're happily stuffing our faces with blue cotton candy. Yusur was soft-spoken and gentle. You just looked at her, and she sort of comforted you automatically. Razan was, to me, she was a little bit more silly. We would crack jokes all the time and sort of push each other's buttons. She liked kids a lot, and we would compete on whether or not her cousins liked me more than her. So that was an ongoing competition. And then Ziyat, like, everyone knows who Ziyat is. He's notorious for his big hugs and his big smile.
Braving the cold on a chilly afternoon at UNC Chapel Hill, Aya Zuri finds comfort at a library. There, she sits down, wearing her traditional Muslim headscarf, and pulls out a laptop computer. On her Facebook page, many pictures of Yusur and Razan are on full display. The photos range from when Aya and Razan were in elementary school together up until recently at UNC Chapel Hill, when the friends painted items for fundraisers.
The Barakats were very notorious for opening their homes for the entire community. Every Ramadan, they hosted a big iftar at their house where hundreds of people came. Any sort of event that they had, whether it was a graduation or a wedding or engagement, it was an open-door policy. There were no invites. It was just everyone was welcome.
So these are some of the paintings that Razan made for our fundraiser over the summer for Gaza.
How much did you raise?
I think almost $30,000.
Wow.
There's a lot of things to remember about them. Probably the biggest thing is their kindness. I think a lot of people have tried to do good things and have a lot to offer the community, but they did this with their hearts fully. And whether it was helping somebody that they knew or somebody that they didn't know, they did it with the same sort of heartfelt love that you don't really necessarily find in everyone.
Helping people that they didn't know was something that Dia and his wife were actively involved with. Both tireless charity workers.
Dia was part of United Muslims Relief's dental mission to the West Bank in Jerusalem, seeing the number of people that needed his help and something that he was really passionate about. I think him and Yusur talked about how to help them on a grander scale, especially given what was happening in Syria. And so Yusur went to Khilis in Turkey at a Syrian refugee camp to help there, and then Dia was starting a campaign to raise money in order to host multiple trips and I think eventually open up a dental clinic to help thousands of refugees that were in Turkey currently.
In a country where gun crime all too often is featured in news bulletins, the details of the killings of 23-year-old Dia Yusur, who was 21, and 19-year-old Razan almost became background noise. Even Aya found it difficult to comprehend.
Recently in Chapel Hill, we've had a few sort of incidents, so it's not completely shocking, but to sort of hear that it was somebody that I knew, and of all people that I knew these three people, I just didn't believe it. It didn't hit me until the next morning driving back to campus and hearing their names on the radio as like another headline that shook me and made it all real. And that was the first time that fear sort of crossed my mind. I've had an incredible experience growing up and living in America. The community here is fantastic, but it sort of hit me that, oh my gosh, that could have been me.
U.S. President Barack Obama has called the deaths brutal and outrageous murders and said in a statement that no one should ever be targeted for what they look like or how they worship. But there have been concerns raised about the media and political reaction to the deaths. with many saying it has been limited and somewhat muted compared to stories with Muslim perpetrators rather than Muslim victims.
The same sort of sentiment regarding like the Charlie Hebdo attacks and ISIS especially, I definitely don't think it's received as much media attention or reaction as it should have. And I urge that people do continue to think about these three innocent Muslim individuals and what they were trying to do for the world instead of the terrible crimes that are committed everywhere.
Despite concerns about the wider response to the shootings, at the community level, 5,000 people paid their respects at the funerals of the victims. And Aya says even strangers at university have shown her support.
Coming back to campus, walking down the halls, people just give me that extra smile and random people coming up and comforting me and saying, like, we're here for you. I think the administration's been wonderful. And then the support that we had at our vigil on Wednesday was incredible. The community has reacted in incredible, incredible ways. There is this new wave of people wanting to understand who we are and what we do because they're confused about what the news is saying about the Muslim community, both in America and internationally, because of the overwhelming reports about what ISIS is doing and the deaths of these three people who did nothing wrong and they committed their lives to serving other people. More and more people are interested in understanding what exactly being Muslim means.
46-year-old Craig Stephen Hicks, a neighbor of the victims, has been charged with the killings. Police say it was a parking dispute, and Hicks' wife has denied that there was any racial motive. His trial for the murders of Dia, Yusor, and Razan is due to begin in March. The FBI is conducting its own inquiry into the case to determine whether any federal laws were violated, following calls from the victims' families for authorities to investigate whether the killings were a hate crime.
Jeff Hamlin sent us that report from North Carolina.
The recent shooting in Chapel Hill has again also drawn attention to the issues of gun control and gun violence in the United States. The country has a particularly powerful pro-gun lobby, a movement that has also taken root in one of its former colonies, the Philippines. The Pacific Island nation has one of the highest rates of gun ownership in Southeast Asia. Many Filipinos see gun ownership as their cultural and historical right. Very few activists have tried to take on the arms industry and the pro-gun government. DW's Jason Strother has the story on one of those anti-gun crusaders from Manila.
Inside this shooting range, located in the basement of a Manila shopping mall, pistols are loaded, triggers are cocked, and shots are fired at paper targets 10 meters away. Gun ownership goes back generations in the Philippines. There's a history of hunting and shooting for sport here. But some see a direct correlation between this tradition and the country's modern rate of gun-related violence.
Oh, it's widespread, national. It's widespread. Everybody will tell you that. And everybody talk Dick and Harry, you know, you can buy a gun. You can get your gun easily.
Renato Pacheco, who goes by his nickname Nandy, is perhaps the Philippines' most outspoken critic of the country's gun culture. He invited me to his countryside home just outside of the capital. Walking past the flock of chickens by the front door, I enter the very spacious dining room. There's a statue of the Virgin Mary in the corner, and atop the upright piano is a picture of Nandy, his wife, and their four grown-up children.
Okay for coffee?
I'm okay.
After a long career as a lawyer and serving in the UN, Pacheco founded the advocacy group Gunless Society 25 years ago. In 1998, he was a vice presidential candidate who ran on a gun reform platform but lost. Today, he's 82 years old, and he's not slowing down. He tells me about one of his earliest memories of gun violence. It was 1942, and the Japanese military had just invaded the Philippines. He, his family, his neighbors, as well as American and local soldiers, were forced at gunpoint to leave their homes in what became known as the Bataan Death March.
Because on the left side of the road were the soldiers, American and Filipino soldiers. On the right side were the civilians. The Filipino soldier would make a sign to us to prepare a civilian clothes. They will transfer to our side. Some succeed, but others, you know, when they're seen by a Japanese soldier, shoots him.
Pacheco says that might be what inspired him to later hate guns. And if you want to know why so many other Filipinos love their weapons, he says all you have to do is look at one of his country's former colonial rulers.
We got it from the Americans. We learned many good things from the Americans. But what we learned most was this addiction to violence, the guns.
Inside his home's small office, Pacheco tells me about the first murder case his gunless society took on as their cause.
This one.
Through his political party, he successfully introduced some reforms, including a ban on carrying weapons on election days. He says it hasn't been easy trying to persuade other lawmakers to see things his way.
The biggest stumbling block here are the politicians. When public officials carry guns with bodyguards, they give a wrong impression. It becomes a status symbol. And I don't understand the people why they always keep voting for these people.
Right on target. Right on the price. These simple words embody who we are.
This is an advertisement for one of the Philippines' largest arms makers. Pacheco says these companies and their political supporters make his country more dangerous.
We shoot as accurately, if not more so, than ammo and firearms costing up to 50% more.
Ernesto Tabuhara agrees that the Philippines can be dangerous, and that's why people need their guns to protect themselves. He heads the lobby group Peaceful Responsible Owners of Guns, or Pro-Gun, and has taken on Pacheco in debates over gun culture here.
Well, first of all, I dispute the fact that there is a direct correlation between gun ownership and crime rate, because that's not just the case. In the Philippines, the crime rate is not due to gun ownership. Actually, it's because of the inability of law enforcement to counter or to arrest all these criminals and terrorists who are operating in our country.
Last year, a new law came into effect that aimed to reduce gun violence, but it actually expanded the list of people who could own multiple firearms. A security analyst I spoke to in Manila says the gun law doesn't tackle the real problem, getting the 2 million unregistered guns out of the country's black market. Those are responsible for many of the 8,000-plus homicides that the United Nations says happen here each year. But there was a lull in violence when Pope Francis visited the Philippines in January.
Bless Almighty Father to accept our offerings in the name of Jesus.
While the pontiff didn't address the country's rate of violent crime during his mass, every word he said was closely followed by many of the Philippines' 76 million Roman Catholics. But Nandy Pacheco, a devout Catholic himself, says Filipinos aren't really listening to the Pope's message of peace.
This country has become a country of hypocrites. There's no love, there's no truth, there's no justice, there's no forgiveness, there's no reconciliation, there is full violence.
Despite what seems to be at times a losing battle, Pacheco says he still has some fight left in him. He's behind legislation that would outlaw carrying firearms in public altogether. Even if that doesn't become law during his life, he says he's proud that he never gave up his cause.
But if it doesn't become a law, success should be measured not by success, but faithfulness. By faithfulness to the cause. That is what matters.
That's why you're not giving up.
Even if I die, I would consider it. I have done the best that I could. I'm happy. That's all that I can do.
Reynaldo Pacheco getting the last word in that report from Manila by Jason Strother.
You're listening to DW's WorldLink. I'm Samantha Early in Bonn, Germany.
And I'm Natalie Muller. You're listening to DW's World Link, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. I'm Natalie Muller in Bonn, Germany.
And I'm Samantha Early. Still to come on World Link,
we meet the young citizens of Mozambique who are yet to see the benefits of their country's abundant natural resources.
And we visit a village in India where residents are seeing the benefits of simple technology to rid their drinking water of poison.
We look behind the stereotyped image of voodoo and meet a modern-day Haitian voodoo high priest.
Each drum rhythm represents a specific wa or specific songs for loa, but because of the polyphonic nature of African sensibilities, the drums themselves are singing, they're talking.
And we sing along with a unique choir in Melbourne, helping stroke survivors find their voice again. All that coming up in this edition of WorldLink.
Mozambique is one of the fastest-growing economies in Africa, thanks to an abundance of natural resources like coal and gas. But impressive economic growth belies a serious youth unemployment crisis, as young people, who form the majority of the 25 million population, struggle to find work. From Maputo, Sam Cowie reports.
The mood is celebratory on Maputo Day, an annual public holiday in the Mozambican capital, where festivities are taking place across the city.
Mm.
20-year-old Beto Magumani Kosa doesn't have much to celebrate. He sits in Bawani Juvenile Prison, where he is finishing up a 2-year sentence for burglary, a crime he says he committed because he couldn't find a job. Beto is illiterate and speaks Shangala, a local indigenous tongue, instead of Portuguese, Mozambique's national language. He has short, unkempt hair, and his clothing is dirty and ripped. Beto says that when he is released, he will follow in the footsteps of his brother and go to neighbouring South Africa to work in mining. He says he will give his wages to his boss to look after or try to open a bank account so that he doesn't spend his money on women and drinking.
With South African wages, I will be able to save enough to buy the materials to build a house. In Mozambique, you can only earn enough to buy the roof.
Beto was orphaned at 14 and for a while lived off the remittances his brother sent from the mines. But when his brother returned home sick with HIV/AIDS and was unable to work, Beto became head of the family. Shortly after Beto was sent to prison, his brother died. Beto's story is echoed across Mozambique, which faces a dire youth unemployment crisis. A 2012 study by the Open Society Foundation estimated that 70% of under-35s were unemployed or didn't have a stable job. That's despite years of impressive economic growth driven by foreign investment, thanks to an abundance of natural resources like coal and gas. Yet Mozambique remains one of the world's least developed countries, with around half the population living in poverty. The extraction projects run by multinational firms create few jobs for local people because they rely on heavy machinery and require little manpower, unlike South Africa's mines, for example. National industry was all but decimated during a 16-year civil war, which ended in the early 90s, and today's private sector creates just 18,000 jobs per year, while 370,000 young people enter the labour market annually. As a result, many young Mozambicans head to neighbouring South Africa to work in mining or agriculture. Unemployment is often cited as a main reason why Mozambique's impressive post-war successes in poverty reduction and healthcare have stalled in recent years.
I got brother there that is a deliver.
21-year-old Ozias Marashava spent 2 years in the Bawani prison for robbery. He stole a woman's cell phone with a group of friends. He says he did it because he was bored and frustrated. Recently released, Ozias, who is fully literate and speaks fluent English, says he and his friends have never had jobs except running errands and washing cars. He says that all of his family went to South Africa to work. His brothers earn money by travelling back and forth between the two countries, buying and selling goods. Ozias, however, wants to go to university and is working towards his high school diploma.
In Mozambique, if you don't start, if you don't go to university, if you don't have a connected family in a companies who can get you a job, it can be too difficult to go there, to find a good thing that can satisfy us. It's hard to find, too hard.
While Azir sees university as his only route to a good job, in reality, it's no guarantee. Fernando Lima, a Mozambican analyst and CEO of independent media firm MediaCoup, employs several interns and says that students often leave university totally unprepared for the workplace.
We create and develop this mentality that only when you have a university degree, someone important. This is bullshit. I'm a CEO of a company, a media company, and I have almost every week kids coming from university trying to start a job here. We receive them here, and 2 weeks later they are out because, one, they cannot adapt, and they are very, very unskilled and very badly trained.
Personal connections also factor in finding a job. The middle classes commonly complain that lucrative public sector jobs are reserved for those close to the ruling Frelimo party, which has governed since independence from the Portuguese in 1975. During last year's election campaign, President Filipe Nussi promised to tackle nepotism in the workplace, which he described as a barrier to development. Analysts like Fernando Lima and members of the UN Farm and Agricultural Organization say that strengthening Mozambique's underdeveloped agriculture sector by providing youth-specific training programs is the key to sustainable employment for young people. At the moment, the sector suffers from a lack of investment, missing modern tools, machines, seeds and growing techniques, which means that young people still associate it with hard labour and poverty. Meanwhile, foreign investments continue to flow into Mozambique, and in the next decade or so, the country is tipped to become one of the world's largest natural gas exporters. However, without significant investments in job creation and education to tackle youth unemployment, Mozambique will remain poor and underdeveloped, and its young citizens will be left behind.
Sam Cowley sent us that report from Maputo in Mozambique.
Turning to another challenge of development and indeed of natural resources, India's biggest experiment with bottled drinking water is unfolding in some remote villages in the eastern state of West Bengal, close to neighbouring Bangladesh. People there were once forced to drink arsenic-contaminated groundwater, but now, thanks to an innovative French technology that purifies contaminated water from lakes and ponds, residents now have access to safe drinking water. DW correspondent Murali Krishnan visited some villages to see how this project is functioning.
Jarna Dosi has been living in Madhusudan Ghati village, nearly a four-hour drive through potholed and congested roads from the state capital Kolkata for over a decade. The 65-year-old, with a pronounced stoop and a frail voice, has suffered, along with the family, from skin and respiratory problems over the years.
This water is bad and many people have fallen ill. In fact, two villagers died after drinking this water over a period of time.
They've had no option but to drink arsenic-contaminated water from tube wells. Surface water in ponds is free from arsenic, but is not fit to drink if it hasn't been purified. People here have been agitating for clean drinking water for years, but the government has been unable to provide it, and they do not earn enough to buy bottled water every day. According to the World Health Organization, drinking arsenic-rich water over a long period results in a long list of health hazards, including skin problems, skin cancer, cancer of the bladder, kidney and lung, besides other diseases. In the adjacent village, a fisherwoman, Bulu Bishesh, is also suffering the effects. She coughs a lot and complains about breathing problems.
I have black marks all over my body, and I know it is because of the water. The doctors also told me that. My husband had to be treated. It was a lung infection. We've been drinking this water for over 20 years. What choice do we have?
Groundwater in 9 districts of West Bengal, including 24 North Parganas, where Madhusudan Ghati village is located, has severe arsenic contamination, which has affected around 16 million people in rural areas and 12 million in urban pockets. But now families here have reason to rejoice, as a pilot project launched by Sulab International, an NGO, and a French organization, 1001 Fontaine, successfully launched a purification process that provides safe drinking water from contaminated local rivers and ponds cheaply. KJ Nath, president of the Institution of Public Health Engineers, explains.
We thought, why not empower the rural community, taking advantage of the traditional surface water sources, which does not have arsenic, but which are highly contaminated with bacteria and other microorganisms.
A cooperative started up in recent months, which is now supplying arsenic-free drinking water to 100 families located in Madhusudan Ghati and selling it to nearby villages at only 50 paisa per liter, which is less than a cent. The village is celebrating as a cooperative has been successful in its marketing campaigns and selling the potable water to other villages in the district. It has managed to tap into West Bengal's countless water hyacinth-filled ponds and put the water through a four-stage purification process using alum and UV filters to produce clean water. At present, the cooperative is purifying and selling 2,000 litres of water every day after pouring it in jars and bottles. Around 200 families outside the village are also regular customers. Bablu Tharubdar volunteers in the cooperative.
This new process is almost godsend. Now all the villagers are happy and I hope it stays this way. We cannot believe this has actually happened.
Jarna Dosi and her family are feeling the impact.
Now we have been able to fight for better drinking water and this will be beneficial for everyone.
The water purification technology has been tested in Cambodia and Madagascar, but it is being used on a larger scale for the first time in the village. Bindeshri Patak is the chairman of project-leading NGO, Sulab International.
This is for the first time. Now the villagers' persons can have safe water to drink without arsenic. So this is a historical moment. We have produced the cheapest water in the world, 50 paise per liter. Never happened before.
In India, providing safe drinking water is each state's responsibility. That the authorities are not doing their part is evident from the fact that more than 1,600 Indians reportedly die every day because of waterborne diseases, according to Health Ministry figures. The ministry points out that more than 130 million people who live in rural areas have no access to clean drinking water. The West Bengal state government, for its part, says it wants more revenue from New Delhi to supply potable water to its population. If the Madhusudan Kati project is an enduring success, the next step could be to take the process to states such as Bihar, then Kerala and Tamil Nadu, areas with major water bodies which account for a third of India's bottled water business, offering the people a cheaper, clean alternative.
That report from West Bengal was by Murali Krishnan.
You may have heard of voodoo. It's a religion from Haiti that emerged from the descendants of various West African ethnic groups brought to the Caribbean nation as slaves in the 16th and 17th centuries. Voodoo often brings to mind images of dolls with pins stuck in them or magic spells.
But beyond the misleading stereotypes, voodoo practitioners say their religion is deeply spiritual, a cultural practice with oral traditions, music and ceremonies that connect them to their African heritage and their triumph over slavery. Today, the religion also has followers outside Haiti's borders, as journalist Rachel Bongiorno found out when she met some voodoo priests at a ceremony in New Jersey, of all places.
On a Saturday night, around 30 people gather in the basement of a suburban New Jersey home. Friends and family greet each other. The scent of grilled fish lingers in the musty air. This is Fete Gede, a ceremony to honour a Haitian voodoo spirit.
My name is Dorothy Desir. I am a high priest in Haitian voodoo. My title is Mambo Asogwe, which means the keeper of the medicinal packet. I am a writer and a scholar, a curator and a mom.
Mambo Dawati has come to co-lead this ceremony. Much like how Mexicans celebrate the Day of the Dead, on Fete Gede, the voodoo community connects with their ancestors.
Gede represents the ancestors They are the Wa, the spiritual forces of those who came before us. Part of Voodoo's covenant is the relationship, the communities that are honored and respected amongst those of us on this plane. That relationship is tied and connected to the communities that preceded us. So we honor and respect those who are among us and visible and living, and we honor and respect those who have come before us.
An altar in the centre of the room is laden with gifts for the Lua to invoke all the senses. It includes bottles covered in colourful sequins and filled with rum, hot pepper, the Lua's favourite drinks. There are baskets of sweets, musical instruments, perfume, candles and raw goat's meat.
We read and perceive the world in multisensory ways. It's visual, it's audio, it's oral, it's tactile, it's all of our senses.
While most people associate voodoo with Haiti, its roots are actually in West Africa. Diwati dedicates much of her time to fostering a greater understanding of voodoo's religious and cultural practices and dispels the myths that plague voodoo. This includes the Hollywood-invented stereotypes of zombies and pins in dolls that were used to perpetuate some of the racist mythologies to justify the US military occupation of Haiti in the early 20th century. By around 11 p.m, the ceremony gets underway. Dressed in a long black cotton dress and black cotton head wrap, Diwati joins her fellow priests to sing in a small circle to the side of the altar.
The singing allows a certain kind of vibration to enter into the universe and allows divine energy to transmit itself that way. Each drum rhythm represents a specific Lua or specific songs for Lua, but because of the polyphonic nature of African sensibilities, the drums themselves are singing, they're talking. They're echoing, they're repeating, they're underscoring and paraphrasing what we are singing. They are a form of prayer. Our dance is our form of prayer.
Diwati points to the legacy of colonisation as the reason for the vilification of voodoo. The religion was outlawed for many years, and in Haiti today, voodoo's legal status remains ambiguous.
There's a historical reason why these traditions have been outlawed. It's because they're tied into resistance. They're tied into our historical resistance, to all the revolutions, to all the revolts, to all the acts of marronage, of seeking freedom that Africans have had, not even the moment we arrived here, but the moment we were enshackled on the continent itself.
It was a voodoo ceremony that united the slaves and sparked the Haitian Revolution in 1791 that led to Haiti being the first post-colonial independent black-led nation in the world. For many Haitian people, voodoo is beyond a religion. It is a widespread cultural practice that is a way to hold on to their African heritage, an avenue for freedom and a spiritual mechanism for healing. However, Diwati did not grow up practicing voodoo in Haiti. It was as an adult in New York City that she came to better understand the religion through the community here.
The group of voodooists were organizing a forum on economic development, on social change, politics. And I thought, what? Voodooists are doing that? Because one is taught that people who practice voodoo are illiterate, they're poor, they're dangerous. There's all these terrible stereotypes.
This coincided with a series of dreams over the course of many years that Diwati says eventually guided her towards searching out her heritage.
The space I should have known most about I should have been most intimate with my own culture, with Haitian culture, with African culture. And yet it is precisely in that space that intellectually that we find ourselves as African descendants most alienated from. We go to school in the West. And the West is not interested in our histories, in our epistemologies, in our ways of being in the world, again, our cultures.
Dorothy is doing more than the voodoo itself.
Another voodoo priest based in New York, Mambo Nicole, says that voodoo is an important way the Haitian community can connect with their heritage. And she sees Dorothy as playing a central role in advocating for people of African descent who practice other Afro-Atlantic spiritual traditions, like Candomblé in Brazil, Orisha in Trinidad or Santeria.
Dorothy is also involved in all the African religions, and which also give us the power to advance together, because basically every nationality, every country, they have their different way of observing the religion, but the spirits are all the same, even though sometimes they have different names.
Because we live in a world as a result of colonialism and the transatlantic slave trade, in some ways we can describe the historical experience of African descendants, particularly in the Afro-Atlantic world, in the Americas, as one that our experience vis-a-vis the West, vis-a-vis the global North, has been about mnemonic erasure. It's been about erasing our culture, erasing our memory, erasing our sense of self. And I see my role as a human rights activist and as a Mambo Asogwe as one that is to help heal that, to repair that gap, to help sort of literally conjure memory so that our sense of self and sense of place is restored.
On January 1st of this year, the UN launched the International Decade on People of African Descent. Dorothy hopes that this decade will be an opportunity to facilitate a better understanding of not just voodoo, but other Afro-Atlantic spiritual traditions, which continue to be discriminated against in the Caribbean and Latin America.
Rachel Bongiorno reporting there from New Jersey in the United States.
And speaking of senses, ceremony and songs in the suburbs, on the outskirts of Melbourne, in Australia, there's a community group that meets every week for a unique kind of social gathering. The members of this group can't actually speak. They suffer from aphasia, which involves a complete loss or reduction of language following brain damage, typically as a result of a stroke. But despite difficulty with speech, they can sing. The community singing program, Stroke a Chord, aims to give them more ways to communicate and express themselves. Reporter Joel Carnegie went along to their choir rehearsal and filed this report.
Welcome to the Stroke a Chord Choir. My name is Tim Adam.
About 4 years ago, Tim Adam, a 49-year-old lawyer, started out his week with a 28K run. He was training for an upcoming marathon. A few days later, he was fighting for his life.
7:30 in the morning, and it happened. So it was a massive stroke. Didn't know whether I was going to live or die, and for 2 days, touch and go, but yeah, it changed my life.
You say go slow, I fall behind.
I've got a wife and 3 kids, it is what it is, you know, and it happened, and so get on with it. Get on with it, and for the first 6 months I talked, say yes or no, or and for 6 months it was like that, and then slowly the words came back. So I'm here now, and it's been a wild ride.
Speech pathologist Bronwyn Jones has been working with the Stroke a Chord Choir since its inception in 2010. She remembers when Tim first joined up, about 2 years in.
He had recently had a stroke and he was not speaking a lot when he first came, and he'd lost a lot of his life being so young. To suddenly lose your work, to lose your physical ability, to lose your speech, they call it a stroke for good reason. It is, you're just struck down, and in a number of ways. He has been amazing in how he has improved both with his speech and with being more and more outgoing.
Gus, for instance, the choir member who sits next to me, has no speech at all, but he can sing along. So it's singing is a wonderful language, I suppose.
The choir can sing because they have music processed in the right side of the brain, or in different, in a bit more diffuse areas of the brain. So singing is left relatively untouched in left hemisphere stroke.
Because not much is known about aphasia, people who suffer from it can become isolated.
They're left without a voice, they're left without communication, and communication is absolutely basic to our everyday functioning. We take it for granted how much this world revolves on being able to recognise the written word and signs in the community, and reading your local newspaper to find out what's going on. And research has shown that people with aphasia are far more likely to experience depression as a result of their stroke. We've seen it with this choir. We have people coming to the choir initially and they're very flat, very down, not smiling at all, not interacting. And after a matter of weeks, they're often interacting with their peers. They feel comfortable because these people also have speech problems. So they feel accepted, they feel comfortable. The music has an uplifting quality about it, and there's often smiles on the faces of both the stroke survivors and their carers for the first time in a long time.
Anya Tanhana is the music therapist working with the Stroke Accord Choir and sees firsthand how it benefits the members.
So a lot of it's about the pleasure of singing in a group. They've shown that that produces positive feel-good hormones and things like that. But the choir is about more than that. It's really about encouraging very active participation in the choir members. And because they have aphasia, there's obviously difficulty sometimes being able to express themselves. So I have a number of different ways that I encourage people to contribute. Sometimes we use sign language, or they might start spelling out a word, or they all have different ways of communicating. But it's a very important part of the choir that everyone feels they can contribute.
For Bronwyn Jones, watching the choir perform has had the most impact on her.
It's really quite astounding watching people and watching the audience as well. This child had never heard her grandfather's voice, and he was just blown away. He could see it in her eyes, and when she said, "Grandpa, that's the first time I've heard your voice," he was absolutely blown away.
Whilst Tim still has a long way to go on his stroke recovery, the choir has offered him an opportunity to communicate again, an ability that's giving him a new lease on life.
My speech therapist put me onto it, and it's been sensational. I can thank her enough. It's exquisite.
Tim Adam ending that report, brought to us by Joel Carnegie from Melbourne, Australia.
For more global stories, check out DWTV's globalisation show Global 3000. More information on the website dw.de/English/global3000.
And that ends our program for today. We hope you enjoy the show, and we'll tune in again next week for more personal stories from around the globe.
WorldLink was produced by Samantha Early and Natalie Muller. Our sound engineer was Jürgen Kuhn. If you'd like to hear any of our stories again, you can always go to our website at dw.de/WorldLink or download the podcast on iTunes. WorldLink is brought to you by DW in Bonn, Germany.